Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
The Grand Rebbe of Joplin, Missouri, said that any farm animal with four hooves and no scales, if subjected to more than 5 hours of slow heat, is kosher. That's the barbecue easement.
This week, my guest is New Yorker staff writer for more than 50 years and the author of an astounding 30 books, including American Fried, Confessions of a Happy Eater, Alice Let's Eat, and Third Helpings, now called the Tummy Trilogy, inspired countless writers, including yours truly, to write about the pleasures of eating regional food. He also writes a monthly political poem for The Nation, for which he has famously said he is paid in the high two figures. He has collaborated with New Yorker cartoonist Raj Chast on a soon-to-be-published children's book, No Fair, No Fair, and Other Jolly Poems of Childhood. Welcome, author, proud parent and grandparent, and serious eater, Calvin Trillin.
Thank you, Ed. If I may make one correction, the high two figures was the offer for each column.
Oh, I see.
By the wily and parsimonious Victor S. Navasky, the then editor of The Nation.
But you didn't take it.
Of course not. I turned it over to my high-powered literary agent and said, play hardball. And he got Navasky up to 100. And
that is hardball.
I still get 100 for each poem. They're weekly, by the way, not monthly. However, as I've written, The Nation publishes only every other week in the summer, even though the downtrodden are oppressed every day of the year.
I love that. All right, so we're at the Little Owl. It's on Grove Street, right around the corner from your house, right?
Grove and Bedford,
and my guess is when Joey Campanaro opened this restaurant, you were thrilled.
Well, I didn't know what it was going to be at the beginning. But yeah, once I got there, I was thrilled. He's a wonderful cook and a good neighbor.
Yeah.
They've been good.
You grew up in Kansas City. In fact, you once famously wrote, "The best restaurants in the world are, of course, in Kansas City. Not all of them, only the top four or five." So your dad was a grocer, if I remember.
Yes. He briefly had a restaurant after he got out of the grocery business. He hated the grocery business. And after he got out and after the Second World War, he eventually had a restaurant for a couple of years, two or three years, although not one whose food I remember.
And what was life like at the Trillin table?
Well, I've said a number of times that for 30 years, my mother served her family nothing but leftovers. And it wasn't until I got out of college that I started thinking, leftover from what? The original meal's never been found.
So was she a good cook?
I would say the subtle and complicated answer to that would be no. She was not a good cook, and she put a lot of things on the table, all of them in little Pyrex glass containers. And sometimes dinner would have 14 or 15 items, and then she would jump up and say, "Oh, forgot the Jell-O mold." And then she'd go
But did you go out to eat? Did the family go out to eat?
Yeah, sometimes. Not that often, but our sort of special occasion restaurant was a fried chicken place called the Green Parrot. It was family style, but that was for sort of birthdays, I think. And we went to Winstead's Hamburger Place. Still there, it's expanded a bit. And it's now considered an architectural treasure.
An architectural treasure.
Yes,
didn't know that growing up, that it would be an architectural.
We didn't know that. It's right on the edge of the shopping district called the Plaza, or as we prefer to call it, the world-famous Country Club Plaza.
Ooh, look what we have here, bud. Some of these sliders that Joey is famous for. And there's your gumbo.
Wow, that's a huge I'm wondering. I wanted the small one, but I didn't want to be impolite.
You've written so much about family, including a line that I have repeated hundreds of times and actually taken as a mantra, which is, your children are either the center of your life or they're not. I have seen you with your children, and I've seen you with so many other people's children, and you have a gift for communicating with them and making them feel that you understand what they're all about.
Well, it may mean that I had a fallback career as a preschool teacher, but it's kind of late for that now.
I think so.
My father loved children, and I don't think my father ever passed a child without stopping to talk, and he was not somebody who was that outgoing. I sometimes say as an icebreaker to a fourth or fifth grader, who is the meanest, awfulest, nastiest kid in your whole class? And you'd be surprised how often the answer is Jason. That's something people should keep in mind when naming children.
And family to you is so inextricably linked to food. Alice, now your grandchildren, have all been characters in your writing for years.
Yeah, a piece I did for The New Yorker on finding a pumpernickel bagel that my daughter, who was then living in San Francisco, remembered from childhood. It has a lot of bagel lore in it, but it's really about fathers and daughters.
Yes, absolutely. And that was in Feeding a Yen.
I think so. Yeah.
But you once said to me, some of my happiest times are eating with my family and another family. What is the connection in your mind between food and family?
Well, I mean, I think that's been true for people forever, that the jolly times they've had is sitting around a table with their whole family, because people are relaxed when they're eating, and of course it's a lot of meals are rituals, and families are built on rituals. Kids love rituals. Kids are very conservative, not politically, but they don't like change. I think it's because they haven't had enough experience to know that things can change and then change back. So they kind of, if you talk about moving from one house to another, kids are usually against it.
Yeah. So when your kids were growing up, did you make it a point of having dinner together?
Yes.
Like that was important.
It was important. And sometimes if we were going out, we would eat early with the kids and then go out. And then we had sort of a rule, which I can't remember exactly, about how many nights in a row that could be. I think you couldn't be three nights in a row or something like that. I think I once wrote that Alice thought that when it came to a child's constitutional right to have dinner with his parents, Alice was a strict constructionist.
Yes. And
also, you get the news, you know, you get all the news. And in high school, it's sort of like soap opera, you know, you wouldn't miss that.
So it was entertaining.
Yeah. And, you know, when kids are younger, I mean, we had kids on sort of the cusp of the changes in the father's role in general. I mean, whether you went into the labor room, whether you change diapers. Mm-hmm. And of course, when a kid is 3 months old, bathing her and changing her diaper is about the only real, and feeding her, about the only real connection you have with her. You can't teach her a better backhand or something like that.
Not in 3 months. Six months.
Maybe. 6 months, baby.
Yeah.
It's not time. And I remember the first time I saw a changing table in a men's room, and I thought, the revolution has finally come. Because in a restaurant, even the most liberated father, when the kid obviously needed changing, would get that look of oh, well, isn't it terrible that the world is arranged this way, but I'll try to keep your food hot while you go. Suddenly it was here. Although, well, I actually have never seen anybody use a changing table in a men's room.
No. I think it's just there by law.
Yeah, but I think it would be nice if it were used more, because as it is, the atmosphere in a men's room is a little edgy. And with the changing table, you could get into talks about talcum powder and stuff like that. That I think sort of reduce the tension of the men's room.
So you left Kansas City and went to Yale.
I admit that.
Was there a reason? Did you really want to get out of town?
Until I was about maybe a junior in high school, I wanted to go to the University of Missouri, drink beer with my friends from high school. And my father, however, who didn't go to college, grew up in an immigrant family in St. Joseph, Missouri, had read a book called Stover at Yale. And he thought that Stover at Yale was Yale. And he thought that's where the sons of the industrialists went, and that's where I should go. I later learned that some bread company in Kansas City gave a 1-2% rebate to grocers who displayed the bread in front and paid their bills right away. And my father put that rebate money away for me to go to Yale.
That was tuition money.
Yeah, I'm not even sure if I was born. I mean, but it was pretty early.
Wow.
So I always said some people went to Yale on a trust fund and some people on bread rebate.
And of course, you used to tell me that when your kids were growing up, that you did tuition gigs.
We call them tuition gigs, yeah. That was speeches for the Bolton Tube Conference or something. It would pay a reasonable hunk of a college tuition. Of course, when my father was paying tuition, I think it was $1,600 a year.
Right.
Room and board included.
Right.
So it was, but I almost, when finally the time came, I decided, oh, well, what the hell, it might be interesting. So I went to Yale, but it was strictly Dink Stover.
That's funny. And when you were at Yale, did you get involved in the pizza wars?
You know, I was just reading something about the Pizza Wars the other day, and I realized it may have been a change of name and everything, but I went to Frank Pepe's.
Yeah.
And there was another place called The Spot.
The Spot is the original Frank Pepe's.
But then Sally's, I don't...
Sally's was down the street and learned to make pizza, Sally, at Frank Pepe's, and then opened his own
place.
Then betrayed him, exactly. Yeah.
I just didn't have Sally's in my mind. But yes, we used to go to, I can't remember the name of the street, start with a W. Worcester Street, yeah.
You didn't set out to be a food writer, right? I know you set out to be a writer and wrote for quite a long time until you started writing about food. And
yeah,
how did that come about?
Well, it came about because in two or three ways. One, I realized that when, say, people from Kansas City got together in New York, talked about missing home, they didn't talk about the restaurant, the fancy restaurant that I used to call La Maison de la Casa House, Continental
Yes.
Cuisine. They talked about the hamburger place or the barbecue place in Canada, the fried chicken place, and that the food that people wrote about, which I guess was in the category of fine dining, wasn't actually what people missed and really liked to eat. And then around a few years later, I was started a series for The New Yorker called U.S. Journal. I did a piece every 3 weeks. Magazine people used to say, how do you keep up the pace? And the newspaper reporters would say, what else do you do?
That's so great.
This looks like real gumbo. Well, I keep saying to myself, this will be the only meal of the day. I can eat whatever I want. Right? Maybe a tiny piece of celery or something for dinner. I have a friend, I might have told you this, from New Iberia, Louisiana.
Yes.
James. You've met
James. Yeah. I think I've met him. Yeah. And isn't he the one that you get the boudin from?
Yes. And he sometimes brings a ice chest full of something. And he makes it, reminded me, he makes a roux that takes him about an hour and a half of stirring until it's just about to burn. One year here, he decided he was going to find the best gumbo recipe in New Iberia. And everybody agreed that the best gumbo was from this Cajun architect of impeccable Cajun descent. And so James expected that there was some herb that grew on the banks of the Chafalaya Basin spillway at a certain week of the year.
Right.
It turned out the secret ingredient was Campbell's cream of mushroom soup. He came up, and at one point he said he was going to make it for us. And at one point he said, I think this would be a good time for some of the more sensitive people to leave the kitchen. And then you heard the can opener go, and then glub, 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 glub. But crawfish etouffee was a post-World War II dish, and that's when everybody was putting cream of mushroom soup into everything. This is pretty good gumbo.
He's a good cook. He's a really good cook. I know you're getting a hamburger today.
Yeah.
And you once wrote that anybody who doesn't think the best hamburger in the world is in his hometown is a sissy.
Yeah, that's true.
I think you need to elaborate on that answer.
Well, what kind of a turncoat could you be if you grew up thinking the best hamburger in the world? Because with hamburgers, people don't say, this is the best one in Tulsa or something. They always say, this is the best hamburger in the world, wherever you are.
Right.
So it seems like a betrayal to go against that. And in fact, in one place, it has to be true. It happens to be Kansas City.
And that's a totally non-biased view.
Absolutely. And a lot of people don't understand the Winstead's hamburger. Because the meat is very thin, and they fail to get it the right way, which is with grilled onions and a double hamburger with grilled onions. So they don't understand. It's like it's people wandering in not knowing. Like, remember, John and Karen Hess wrote a book about eating in America.
Yeah, sure, I have it.
And they went to Arthur Bryan's in Kansas City,
which you once called the single best restaurant in the world.
Yeah, within a context, yes.
Yeah.
They were disappointed in it. And I realized, gee, how could that happen? Because they're such a distinguished couple. And then I realized, distinguished couple, they walked in and they were so distinguished among the people who ordinarily go to Brian's that the counterman reached under the counter for the tongs, the guy who pulls your plate over and picks up the ribs with his hand and throws it on the plate. He picked up some tongs that were under the counter, had last been used for a visit by Emperor Haile Selassie in 1936. And what nobody told the Hesses, it was about 30% of the taste is in the guy's hand. So they missed that. And I can understand why they thought it was disappointing. But
that's
you
funny.
Have to defend your hometown places.
Yes. So, no, I would agree with that. Now I understand the context of the remark, it makes sense.
Well, the context of the remark about Bryant's, which I knew was Charlie Bryant's, when I got home from college the first time, I wanted to see if they were open, and I looked under the in the phone book, and I couldn't find Charlie Bryant's. It was just called Bryant's then. Charlie started it and then died a few months later. That was in the context of two soldiers in Fort Riley get through with basic training, and they're given a pass, and they're going to go into Kansas City. This was in the 50s. And they go to the USO to find out where to eat. And one of them is black and one of them is white, but they're buddies. And the woman says to the black, gee, I don't know where. Said, well, there's this little place in Colored Town, she would say. And so then they went to Colored Town. This is all in my imagination. And it's getting a little darker, and the white guy's thinking, well, he was brought up not to worry about the color of a man's skin, but he's getting a little concerned. And he gets it, Brian. There's a big dusty jug of barbecue sauce in the window. It looks like a kind of down and dirty place. And he said, no, this is my friend. I'm going to stick with my friend. And he walks in, and he's in the best restaurant in the world. For the first time in the history of Republic, virtue has been rewarded. The other guys are eating this awful stuff at the Forum cafeteria. Just because he was true to his friend, he's there. And in that context, I call it the best restaurant in the world.
I've never heard the context for that remark. You grew up in Kansas City. You've written a lot about the joys of eating barbecue and other forms of trafe. But you once told me that that your family had a special dispensation to eat pork.
Well, that's the barbecue easement promulgated by the Grand Rebbe of Joplin, Missouri, who said that any farm animal with four hooves and no scales, if subjected to more than 5 hours of slow heat, is kosher.
Oh, that's unbelievable.
That's the barbecue easement.
That's the barbecue easement?
Yeah. Works for the whole. It doesn't work just for Joplin. It works for every place.
It's a worldwide.
It's a worldwide easement. He's a very important rabbi. He's usually described as a noted Talmudist and pitmaster.
So, you wrote a book called Feeding a Yen, right?
Feeding a Yen.
And in the book, you express the view that certain foods should be eaten only in the regions they originate.
Well, if you're able to do that, if you're lucky enough to get around that much, and there, you know, Kansas City, like say Memphis and Houston, maybe places like that, are sort of second generation, and New York increasingly, barbecue places. I mean, they're not places where barbecue started. They're barbecue
right.
Where somebody brought them from somewhere else.
Yeah, I call them digital barbecue joints.
Yeah, that's true. But what I've always been interested in is, one of the reasons that I've never written about fine dining restaurants is, one, I don't particularly care for that sort of eating. But two, I was interested in places that had connection, food that had connection to the place, sort of vernacular food. And the fine dining restaurant in Denver and the fine dining restaurant in Houston are the same restaurant. They're not a reflection of where they are. They're the opposite of vernacular thing. In fact, they might make a thing about being from somewhere else.
Right, exactly. Except, of course, now the fashion is...
Now fashion is local.
Well, right, so they're creating a Houston cuisine.
Right. That's right. Although it's sometimes, as we would say at home, not so as you'd know it.
Exactly. Well, you once said to me about your lack of interest in eating at Michelin-starred restaurants that if you never ate at another one of them, that would be fine with you. And you said, what they serve there is interesting and admirable, but am I really having a good time?
Yeah, that's right. I'm usually okay through the appetizer. But then, particularly the really fancy kind of Kropotchka restaurants, I think of, well, it's very interesting that they can do this much to food. But did God really intend this to happen?
Next time on Special Sauce, Serious Eats Podcast, Ed Levine continues his conversation with Calvin Trillin when we learn about Trillin's exclusive club of reporters covering America.
There were only two of us in the organization, and there was only one rule, which was you can't quote de Tocqueville.